This is the Alien UFO Podcast, episode 230, and I'm your host, Simon Bowne. To hear the extended version of this episode, please join Patreon. This week, I'm talking to John Majerowski about his book, Contact and Control, UFOs, DNA, and the Hidden War on Human Potential. John is an information security professional, Freemason and experiencer, and he hosts the UFOs on the Level podcast. Hi, John. Thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
Thank you, Simon. I appreciate it.
Well, we're going to talk about your book. It's called Contact and Control, UFOs, DNA, and the Hidden War on Human Potential. But before we get into that, can you tell us about your own UFO encounters?
Yeah. And again, thank you for bringing me on. The thing started for me is that when I was a child, I had experiences with what we would call ghosts or, non-corporeal entities, not human intelligences. And I really very young had that happen. And since that moment, I kind of realized that there is more to reality than what we're being told. Through that experience, later on, I had my own experiences. My father basically had an experience when he was in his teens in Toledo, Ohio, and he was pumping gas at a gas station in the 50s or early 60s, and he came outside to, pump the gas into the car, and everybody was frozen in the streets, and blocks were just standing around. Traffic was stopped, and people were gazing at the sky at a long, cigar-shaped silver craft that was there for a long time and kind of just drifted away. And from that experience, he told me at an early age that it was life-changing for him. He had that experience and another one in the late 70s with more people around as well, the disc-shaped craft and the darkness. So when I grew up, I just was under the assumption my dad's never going to lie to me. I mean, why would he lie to me about any of these things? So UFOs were real. And then he during his journey went through the entire thing of, well, what are these things? All the books we can get our hands on, all the films at the time, you'd have to mail away a postcard and get a VHS tape back in the mail with a lecture of like maybe Linda Moulton Howe talking about a cattle mutilation and things like that. And so as a kid, I was just under the assumption that this was real. It wasn't until, later into my teens that I found the control mechanism of, well, your tinfoil hat, you're crazy, you're making these things up. People that see these things are unstable. And then I realized that there's a control mechanism behind that. But to get back to your question, sorry, that was a long way around, was that I have had my own UFO experiences and with my family and with my brothers, my Freemason brothers as well. And that one was along the CE5 variant where we sat around in a circle and played some binaural beats and meditated, basically a really loose translation of kind of Stephen Greer's CE5 protocol. But what we did was just imagine wherever we're sitting is Google Maps, and we're at the base level where we're sitting around, the campfire, and all the way up into the middle of the universe, and just projecting that from that space up and back down, and sending out intentions of love and peace and happiness, and just asking for somebody to give us a sign and to say hello. And for two nights in a row, that did happen, and filmed that with a night vision color camera. And it was pretty amazing to have the orange orbs come down. Had orange orbs before that with my wife driving in a rainstorm and a sleet storm. And then the experience that really made me want to buckle down and write the book was my 2-year-old daughter, Stella. It was July 5th, 2020. We were outside. It was really hot and we were hanging out, water balloons, messing around. And she was 2 years old at the time. And she laid down on the deck, which is something she had never done before. Lay down. And she said, "Daddy, lay down right here. Put your head right here." I'm thinking, what's going on? So she's like, "Daddy, daddy, daddy." So I put my head back, head to head, laying down flat on the deck. And I looked up, giant white orb right over the house and in the backyard. And she said, pointed to it and said, "Yeah, yes." And that was her name for it. Yeah, yes. And it was nothing. I still haven't figured out where that came from. I never talked to her about UFOs or orbs or any of those things. And she just had to get me into the position to look up and see it. And when I did, I was just shocked. Got cell phone out. The neighbors came outside. Everybody's looking at these things. And then my mother, daughter, Addison came outside and said, "Well, there's another one." As soon as she walked out the back door, there was two. So we looked at them for a long time. And much like the other experience, and people after a little while just got bored of it and kind of went about their business, cutting their grass and going on with it. I mean, everybody was looking at with binoculars, trying to figure out what it was. Of course, I made a MUFON report, and they came back and said it was a weather balloon, which is the best answer ever, right? I think it's just probably pick one of these answers and tell the person this is what it was. So that was a big experience and for the family. And that's what started me down the road of, well, I really need to document. This has really been going on, and it's not just about lights in the sky. And just start getting this documented, you know?
And what about when you were a child and you said you had ghosts and non-human intelligences that visited you at night?
Yeah.
Would they communicate with you?
You know, and that was the odd thing. They didn't. And it was a, now that I've done the research and, you know, the common vernacular, I would say, would be shadow people or shadow beings. It would be a dark, basically black outline of a human figure, and they were just in the corners of the room at all times, or coming, you know, peeping around door frames, you know, at me and watching me. And that happened as far back as I could remember. I think I even wrote in the book at one point, I must have been four, and I got a little pop-up tent for Christmas, I think. And I was so scared that I would sleep with all of the lights on, and I put that tent in the middle of the room and would sleep in that tent with a radio on so I couldn't hear or see anything. And that happened for years. They just wouldn't go away. They were there all the time. And it wasn't menacing or, you know, hurtful in any way. It was just an ever present presence of them. And I think that the hard part was there was no communication. There was no, you know, I had no idea what was going on. And as a child, it's really hard to explain to, you know, your parents what was happening. And, you know, I just try to describe it. And, you know, there were times they would stay with me and, you know, not see anything, obviously, but it was kind of impactful as a kid, definitely. And then the very first experience I had was, like I said, I wrote this as well. There was probably five or six, and I was throwing something away in the kitchen, and there was a door that went to the basement, and I looked up, and there was a man, probably 6'2", brown, old fashioned suit, brown bowler style hat. He looked down at me and smiled, but weird part was I could see right through him. It was kind of misty, like a shadow, but I could see through him, but it wasn't menacing anyway, but it scared me. Because of that, I ran out, screamed, and told my dad what I had seen, and I described the man perfectly. You know, of course, dad thought somebody had broken in the house, went in there, but there's nobody there. What are you talking about? Told him, and he said, well, that sounds exactly like the guy that lives next door, or used to, because that older man had passed away a few years before that. So that's when I really went down the journey of, well, this is something that's happening, and I know it's real, but I can't explain it. And as a kid, it's even more hard to grasp what's going on at that point.
You have a qualification, CISSP, and your book is called Contact and Control, UFOs, DNA, and the Hidden War on Human Potential. So how does your qualification help you in your research in analyzing these things?
Oh, thanks. It's CISSP is a Certified Information Security Professional, and it's one of the tenets of that is how to look at information systems and how they hide things. And look for mitigation and mitigating controls, right? For the confidentiality, integrity, and availability of information systems. So I'm supposed to give you an example, look at a brand new piece of software and see where there's vulnerabilities. For example, how could this piece of software be leveraged for, you know, exfiltration? If there's a way that somebody could get data out of this that's not authorized, how would that happen? How would you protect that in that situation, and what would be the mitigating controls that you put around that information or that system to prevent that from happening, or at the very least be informed of anybody attempting to do that. So when I started my real in-depth research into this, you know, if you look at how information systems hide things and who benefits from the hiding, then patterns start to emerge when you stop looking at like individual events and you start looking at the infrastructure around them. And what I found was a control architecture, and it's been running far longer than most people know. the conversation in ufology has been split into believers and debunkers for decades, and I'm neither. You know, I tried to look at it from all aspects, because there's a large part of my life where I didn't want to believe these things were real. And, you know, you fall into the debunker side where these can't be real because a lot of them are frightening and scary. And why would, you know, you put yourself through that? And then there's the other side where you want to believe that every synchronicity is something that's, you know, pointing you in a direction that you need to go in, or every light that you can't explain in the night sky is a UFO. But if you look at it from a middle road, if you look at it from both sides, you can kind of see what is shaping to be, like, as I said, a control system. There's infrastructure that's built around these things to control the phenomenon, I would say, and human perception of that as well, and how you perceive it and interact with it.
So it's like controlling the narrative in a way, because there was a thing you mentioned in your book, the 1952 Robertson panel, and they were trying to bring in some form of control.
Yeah. So the Robertson panel, there was a big UFO flap after 47 in the United States, when, you know, everybody knows about Roswell now, though. And there was a big flyover in, I think, 1952 in Washington, D.C., that were for days at a time. It was all over the press. And, you know, there was these craft flying all over the Capitol. And everybody was demanding answers. And they had the military and the Air Force, the newly formed Air Force. Everybody was trying to get down to the bottom of it. So the big thinkers at the time decided to convene. And they put together this thing called the Robertson Panel, where they had a bunch of the intellectuals and everybody that were pretty much high in academia and military at the time, and say, what are we going to do about this? We need to study this, but at the same time, we need to be able to do it in private and have the public not be basically freaking out. So they had this panel, and the outcome of the panel was a classified document that was only released, I think, in the 70s. It might have been even later than that. And basically what that was they said that we need to study this in private. So how do we do that? Well, we need to discredit the people that are having these experiences, the witnesses, the people that are seeing these lights in the sky, that are witnessing these events. And we do that through ridicule. So we ridicule them. We ridicule the topic itself, you know, the tinfoil hat, as we all kind of know now. The, you know, you're kind of crazy. You're not, you know, right in the mind. And if you discredit the person, you can discredit the topic altogether. But at the same time, in the background, they did really focus and study and worry about if this thing that was happening could be a foreign nation, could be used by a foreign nation as a cover for maybe an invasion, could be used to jam up all of the phone lines at the time in the 50s. If you had everybody calling and jamming the phone lines, communication would shut down. And they were really worried about it either being a weapon or being weaponized. So the ridicule set in, and basically, not only the U.S., but the world has been still to this day running on the premise of the Robertson panel, where we're just going to discredit everybody who has the experiences and then in the background do something completely different.
So was there any influence that they might have had over the media, whether it's newspapers or radio or TV, where they were asking them to, you know, to have a certain narrative that people who see UFOs are crazy or imagining it?
Yeah, of course. I think Operation Mockingbird was released as well, and through Freedom of Information Act, where basically the CIA and the intelligence community in the United States had their influence on every media, newspaper, radio, television at the time to push the narrative or reinforce the narrative that people were crazy. This is nothing. This is no big deal. And anybody that kind of stepped out of that lines got a visit and a talking to. And that happened, and some may say that that still has a little effect. I mean, now with the global communication, it's harder to shape that narrative, but some would argue that it's still in play today with the major news media, for sure, that to keep this quiet, it's for national security. We need to protect everybody, and this is how we're going to do it. So yes, it's a huge influence.
I suppose in 1952, when it all started, it was a different society, wasn't it? The World War II had just finished. All the men coming back from the war, they'd been in the military. They understood secrecy and looking after the country. So if their government came to them and said, we want you to lead this way in the media when it comes to UFOs, they were much more open to do that than they would be today.
That's a really great point. I think you're right. There was, I mean, the majority of most men in America and pretty much, well, in your country as well, were served in the war, and people around the war as well. So people that were here at home, the women and other people that were here were part of the war effort. And the propaganda machine behind that was, you know, loose lips sink ships, right? So you don't want to,
yeah,
you know, there were posters about that and, you know, things to prevent, you know, help the war effort. So everybody was had a strong sense of national pride and national security. And at the time, communism was on the rise. And that was the biggest next fear, that we were going to have to, you know, battle that on the front. So this is just basically an extension of that. Just, you know, be quiet, cover this thing up. We need to protect ourselves. So, of course, very good observation there.
So you say in the book that you feel most likely that mankind has reverse engineered these kind of alien craft. I think they call them alien reproduction vehicles. I mean, we've never seen anything come out, have we? We've seen stealth bombers. They've revealed them, stealth fighters,
right,
and other technologies. But do you feel that perhaps these alien reproduction vehicles, if they exist, are so secret, they just have to keep them quiet?
Yeah, I really do. I think that there's a concerned effort, obviously, that none of that technology be revealed, only on the timeline. And there's a chapter in my book called The 30-Year Rule. And basically, technologies don't emerge from classified programs fully formed. They're like laundered through the private sector, released incrementally through like charismatic front people, and then brought to market on a timeline that protects the programs behind them. And I spent years studying how that works from a security standpoint, and the pattern's unmistakable once you see it. There's very interesting examples that I have sourced. And that's the thing that really took me the longest time writing this book, is that everything in it is cited and sourced. The end note section is, there's almost 500 end notes. So when I'm speaking about these things in the book and I put the references in, you can go and look and see these declassified documents or other articles or books that have been written about these topics. And the premise is basically the newest technology that you have in your hand right now, the iPhone, the whatever is the most top of the line technology, is at least 30 years old. And it's only been released because the military-industrial complex has something that far surpasses it. So when you look at, for example, you said stealth technology, you have, I think it was the SR-71 bomber. It was during Ronald Reagan's administration. He said to a reporter that, well, we have an invisible plane. And it was, at the time, everybody's going, what did he say? And then everybody on the intelligence side said, oh my God, he said it. What are we going to do now? And so that was in the 80s, and they rolled that thing out, and it had been built and operational since the 60s. So you look at it from that perspective, the things that are flying around in the sky, the brand new fighter jets are at least 30 years old. And the things that we have beyond that are really kept really closely guarded secrets, and they're, you know, used for the, I wouldn't even want to imagine the purpose. I would imagine they were used for intelligence gathering and things of that sort. But yeah, the alien reproduction vehicle, that story is, there's too many factors in that would make it be not something to at least investigate even further, you know, deeper into that. There's, of course, always the thing that they say in this field and in ufology for sure is different disinformation or passage material or things they want to get out into the public for disinformation or to influence another country's thoughts about our technology or our advancements, right? So that is at all possible. But there always has been, and if you look back at, like I said, the 30-year rule, there's always been technology that's been flying around in our skies that's at least 30 years, if not more, advanced. So would seem plausible that we have these technologies and we use them regularly, I would imagine.
I suppose it's all compartmentalized, isn't it? And there's so many people in the military who just wouldn't know they exist, or probably wouldn't even believe they exist. And then there's a small amount that control what they do with them. And maybe, you know, the president doesn't know about them.
Exactly. I mean, I've heard that from more than one person, is that the president is just a temporary employee. The president is there for, at the most, for 8 years. So these programs have been running for 70 years plus, and the people behind that are 30, 40, even plus year career people in the military and intelligence community, and as well as the aerospace companies, right? And it's a revolving door. I mean, a lot of people that retire out of military and go directly from the military into one of the Lockheeds or the Raytheons or one of the other contractors that just turn right around and contract for the government. And those people, they're generals or whatever, and they've been in the military forever. They have all the connections. They know all the people. They know how it works from the inside. And now they're working on the outside in the private sector, but they're back hand in hand. So they have all their connections and the people that are there. And it's just basically a revolving door. You see it in not only that, but in the health care sector and everything else. So I feel like it's a big issue, but being a capitalist society, I can see how that works, but these things are hidden, as you said, basically from the president for deniability. They probably learned from Reagan from when he opened his mouth, not to tell them too much about our advanced capabilities, unless it was absolutely need to know. And you're right that number is very small, very small.
And do you get the impression that other countries have also achieved this? Maybe Russia, China?
Yeah, I do. I think that's part of one of the main concerns, and I use concerns loosely. I've heard stories and spoken to people that said that behind the scenes, some of our allies on this topic, on the UFO topic, would be fascinating. That in the public, say for example, China, we're neck and neck battle, or Russia, as the United States, and you know, but on this topic, that maybe we work together in private on it. And we have in the past, at some point, maybe that dissolved, for whatever reason. But yeah, I know there's been reports in from Russia, obviously, as a massively big country of retrievals, crash retrievals, China as well. There's a lot in the ocean that everybody fight over, that happen, international waters, things like that. So yeah, there's a mad race, I would say, in the background to reverse engineer the technology. And obviously we as humans want to turn it into machines of war, unfortunately.
And it does seem that with those craft, the maneuverability they have is incredible, and that any country, if they had them, could park a UFO over any city with an atom bomb in it, and there's no way of defending against that. The craft can get there almost instantly.
Yeah, that's we've talk to my friend Jay Anderson. He's got a great podcast called Project Unity, and he and I have spoken, and we've spoken to some people in the background as well. And you know, I think they use the term with us as a instantaneous nuclear weapon delivery system, which is mind-boggling and terrible when you think about it. Very scary, right? You can just be parked right, like you said, parked right over your capital or any building, and at any moment let that thing loose.
And there's nothing we could do about it.
Unless we were racing to have our own craft to combat it, right?
The deterrent, the mutually assured destruction.
Exactly. Same thing with nuclear weapons. If you use that model, it seems like that's the next nuclear race that's happening in the background.
So if we move on, there's something else you discuss in your book, is the new wave of disclosure. But it's also like, why is there a new wave? What's changed? What's your viewpoint?
Well, I mean, my viewpoint's always changing on that. And, you know, whenever I'm presented new information, I like to incorporate it and see if it sticks. But there's been a push, I believe. There always has been. There's been these many waves of disclosure that always happened in the 80s. And it's always been, in the United States anyways, it's been brought about by the intelligence community to try to shape the narrative. So they're bringing out these, you know, former military, former intelligence people, former people that are, you know, most of the time, I'm using air quotes, former, they may still be working for the government in some capacity, maybe not directly, but as a contractor, as I said. So these people are the ones that are always out front championing disclosure as an insider, as somebody who's, you know, seen the inside and wants to break it to the public and tell everybody what's going on. It's interesting how that pattern always holds. You know, I joke when people say, well, you're just a conspiracy theorist. And I say, no, I'm a pattern recognition expert. You know, once you start looking at the patterns, you can see the control system behind it. And I think that this wave of disclosure was brought about for a multitude of reasons. And I'm not sure if I actually got this part down in the book or not, but I know I've spoken about it a lot on my podcast, is that I think that at because of all the years of muddying the waters, and, you know, Project Blue Book was basically just a way to, you know, explain away all of the anomalous experiences that people in America were seeing. You know, not, like I said in the beginning here, when I reached out to MUFON, they said it was a weather balloon, which was their, you know, go-to response, or swamp gas, which was another famous one here, to basically quell people's experiences and tell them that they were crazy, following the Robertson panel's methodology. And then with the rise of social media, and we can, well, I mean, look, right now we're talking from across the ocean real time, you know, in phones. We can pull a phone out of your pocket and you have a 4K video of live streaming to the internet of anything you see at any time. We're interconnected in ways that we have never been connected before. So like you said earlier, the way that the military or intelligence would quell the media was, you know, the gag orders, the Project Mockingbird, where they have people in those companies, or, you know, working for those, or like I said, they would have a conversation with you about not putting that news story out. You're not going to stop a, you know, a billion people from doing it instantaneously over the internet. So I think that the perception management had to take effect. And, you know, Tom DeLonge famously came out as, you know, saying that this was his mission and this is what he was going to do to bring about this part of disclosure, is that his pitch to the military and industrial complex was, you've been painted in a bad light for 70 years. You've, you know, threatened witnesses, intimidated witnesses. You controlled the narrative, controlled the media, and nobody believes you anymore. Even if they came out right now and said that, you know, we have communication with non-intelligent life and we have for 30 years, everybody wouldn't believe you, because you've had not a really good track record on any of this. So how do we shape that narrative? How do we shape that perception into something where you, even though you have been the bad guy for all these years, how do we shape it into a narrative where you look like you're in a better light? How do we show that you've been really working behind the scenes to protect everybody and to make sure that you can go to that baseball game and you can go to your soccer game and all these things, and still not have to worry about these bigger picture things, and you know, bring back the patriotism and that America is doing these things for the right reason. And I think that the 2017 New York Times article that was part of the DeLonge's TTSA, and that was part of the recent push, right? The recent push to come out and get on the other side of the narrative to make them look like the good guy for once. And the other part of that is what is uncomfortable truth is that they're also seeking amnesty. And that's arguable, I would say. I mean, some of those things, obviously, we don't know the full story, but there were, you know, stories of people being murdered, silenced, things like that, for being involved in this topic. And as you know, recently in the news, we have over a dozen, you know, here in America, over a dozen scientists and people that are, you know, working on cutting edge technologies or things that are tied to the UFO topic that are being murdered or they're missing. So it's still potentially a tactic that's still being used, and it's not a good look. And obviously I think what they're trying to do is come out and say, well, we had to do all these things in the name of, you know, what we had to do to protect you. So I think the latest push is open the window enough to get people to, you know, be aware of these things, to not be scared about it, to turn off the Robinson panel influence as high as it is, and change the narrative that the reason that all those things had happened is because we're the good guys, which is interesting, I think. But like I said, that's just my current hypothesis. It could change at any moment.
And also there's the thing of calling them UAP and not UFO. It's like a rebranding.
Yeah, and that was purposeful as well. Jay Stratton, I said that in my book, that he was the one who came out and said that was on purpose to reshape the narrative, because of the UFO had such a stigma from the Robinson panel. When you said UFO, you're a UFO nut, UFO, you know, you're crazy. Before that, it was flying saucers. So, you know, the rebranding keeps happening. So UAP sounds more like a military term that's, you know, it holds a different context. So people go, well, what's that? Oh, okay. But most people, at least my age, said, so UAP, oh, you mean UFOs, right? So it goes back there. But yeah, definitely rebranding, recycling, you know, getting a whole new narrative on it.
Hi, Simon here. For years, I've spoken with people who describe experiences that defy easy explanation. Missing time, alien beings, telepathic contact, and memories that sometimes only surface under hypnosis. My new book, Aspects of Alien Abduction, Shocking UFO Encounters Volume 1, explores these experiences through the voices of those who have lived them. This isn't about sensationalism. It's about patterns. The details that appear again and again across different people, different places, and different lives. Aspects of Alien Abduction, May 25th, on audiobook, Kindle, and paperback. And there's also how far can they go with the disclosure and how much do they know? Will they just say they have crashed vehicles and maybe some dead bodies, but they won't say we have communication with them or alien abduction's a real thing and there's nothing we can do about it? They would probably try and clamp it down as much as they can, wouldn't they?
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, you know, the people that are running this latest push, like you have Luis Elizondo out there who... his entire career was, counterintelligence, counterterrorism. And if you look at what that is basically you infiltrate a group of people or whatever that you need to, you know, get inside of, figure out how it works, figure out the ins and outs, the communication, every side, and you infiltrate it and you basically destroy it from the inside out and you spread your message of what you want to relay or what your outcome is internally, and you organically build people that are on your side or you know, believe they're empowered to do these things or they're fighting for the cause, and then you unleash them. If you follow the playbook, there's, you know, some interesting army and different other branches of counterintelligence, and you just look at that in light of what we're looking at it for modern ufology, it mirrors really close. So come in, divide, conquer, have people destroy from the inside out. Control the narrative, so at the end you have a message in a narrative that you want that everybody to believe, and potentially that's what's happening, at least on some of the fronts that I've seen and personally witnessed.
And I believe there's some people in government in the USA who are very strong Christians, and they believe aliens are actually demons. That's a problem, isn't it?
Well, yeah, that was a big thing that we heard early on, that there was a loose group of very, like as you said, very Christian people, and these people were not necessarily politicians, but some of them were, but a lot of them were I guess we loosely call them the gatekeepers. The people we were talking about have been in the military for 40 years and they're never going anywhere. And their belief was that these were demonic, that the things in the sky that people were seeing and these entities were demons and we shouldn't be interacting with them and we shouldn't even be studying. We shouldn't put any money towards it. We shouldn't even mess with it. And those people called loosely the Collins Elite. And I'm not sure the backstory on that. If I dig back in the deep parts of my mind, I'm sure I could figure that out. But yeah, that was pervasive and it may still be so. And it's interesting to look at that and say, well, who's spinning that narrative? Is there a deeper connection to the Vatican? Is there a deeper connection to something that's informing that decision? Or is it just a belief structure that's run rampant for the past 40, 50 years that people just keep going on? Interestingly enough, there's people that have had these experiences and, you know, it had interactions with these non-human intelligences or craft or whatever. And it's interesting to hear the reports that these people are actually becoming Catholic, believe it or not, after these experiences, who may not have been religious or not, you know, not via Catholicism anyway. And they are now converted to Catholicism. So it's interesting. And seems like a good topic for another book, but that's true. And you have Congresswoman Luna coming out saying that maybe these are demons, and other other congresspeople saying that as well, that, you know, they could be. J.D. Vance, you know, the vice president of the United States, says that, I don't know if they're actually UFOs. I don't know if they're angels and demons, you know, on different news programs. So, what's going on in the background? What kind of intelligence are they getting? And are they being controlled by the phenomenon itself or another control mechanisms that's controlling their perceptions and their realities as to what these things are?
But also something you note in the book is the disclosure movement is gaining serious momentum in all sorts of areas like Congress, online, and in the media. But at the same time, the population don't seem to care that much.
It's kind of amazing, right? It's like, and it's almost like it's on purpose. If you look at it back, I would say COVID probably changed the world in more ways than we'll ever know. You know, once that happened, if you look at everything that's happened since then, you have the Epstein files, those things, and the getting everybody demanding the truth, the JFK assassination files that have been locked up for, 60 plus years, 70 years, and demanding all these things to come out. And of course, UFOs and the unexplained, that goes hand in hand. People are demanding answers. But I would say that because of the way we communicate now and because of the hyper connectivity that everybody has, it doesn't hit as hard as it does when, if you go back to like 1982 and you turn on the news and there's a special report that something happened, right? And everybody stops what they're doing and focuses on one thing. Now our attention's spread out so far and vast that you can't. I think I read somewhere that the average attention span for an adult in America is 8 seconds or less. And it's like the TikTok and the reels and the things that are just short little bursts of video or information hitting you. And people don't have the capacity anymore to really think deeply as we once did, or not everyone, I would say a lot of people don't, but also there's a lot of people that, have a lot of things to worry about day to day. How am I going to feed my kids? How am I going to, I need a job. I need, home, my car's broken down. I can't afford gas, things of that nature that, thinking about non-human intelligences doesn't even show up on your radar at that point, right? You just got to get through your life. So it's interesting to see that I think they've kind of massaged it in a way that, when if they came out tomorrow and said, yeah, we've been doing this, we've been communicating with these things, or as you said, we have crash bodies and craft, but we don't know what's going on. People would just go, "Heh, okay, we knew it," and, move on.
yeah.
By design. I think they did, because before, I would think it would be, people say, it's too hard to digest, or it's earth shattering, or religions would have a hard time with it. But I don't know. I think that if you've basically numbed down society to where everybody's numb to these type of things, then the realization of them probably would be less impactful.
So I wanted to change the subject now and talk about Philip Corso. And he had his book out with all these claims in it, but you talk about the original manuscript. Was it Dawn of a New Age? And was there a lot more information in there that's interesting?
Yeah, that's definitely interesting. And I got that sent to me by somebody who had it. And it's a completely different book if you look at the two of them. And it seems like Corso just, being an author myself and a new author, I understand the writing process. I tried to get a rough sketch of everything I wanted to talk about and, notes of, okay, here's this part and expound upon this and then, tie it into here and basically an outline. And it feels like that, but it also feels like there was emphasis on things that he felt were important that were not included in the final draft of the book at all, which is interesting. And there was some reports from his children, I think it was his son, who said that he wasn't happy with the final draft. He had an editor that edited with him and co-wrote the book with him. And there was a lot of things that were taken out, and there's a lot of project names that he mentioned that nobody's ever been able to do information requests on. And that there's never been anything that has come out about that. But some of those things that are very interesting in there that weren't public. So you wonder if that's another control mechanism. Was the publisher or the author or the co-author, were they told not to include a lot of things for national security reasons? Was it all passage material? Was it all just things that were made up for disinformation and they took it out? But If you look at the two, it's interesting to see how the manuscript changed completely in there. And the projects that he said that they were working on were very interesting.
So you wouldn't feel he's a misinformation agent?
You know, in this field, I really try not to pigeonhole anybody into one space. Possibly. And there's the thing, too, is that I've heard this from time to time as well, is that this always happens where, say, for example, that there is somebody working with the government that's, you know, from the government that's trying to get this information out, and they're trying to give it to somebody who they want to disseminate this information. And they're always, it's never been just one-for-one true information. There's always some type of disinformation or passage material in there so that at any time they can flip a switch and just burn that source and say, no, that's all made up. That's junk. Because look, this one part of this, maybe there's 5,000 pages of documentation, right? And there's five of them that are just complete garbage. But they'll point to the five and say, look, this is just trash. So that means everything else is trash, right? Just throw it all out. So, you know, could you be unwillingly part of, or unknowingly part of that? Sure. I'm sure that happens all the time for everyone.
There's all sorts of things, isn't there? It's like with Bob Lazar saying he worked at Los Alamos.
Right.
And him, he was at MIT, and they deny any knowledge of him, but then they find him listed in Los Alamos phone book.
Yeah.
It's almost like if you've got a job like he did at Area 51.
Right.
There's a team almost assigned, like, okay, he started at Area 51, go through his past and erase anything that might help him.
Yeah, and that's true. I mean, I'll give you an example from my my real world experience from being in information security. When I was graduating college or getting out of college, I was applying for different agencies and entities, right, that deal with information security and you know, national level. So, you know, any of the three letter agencies, let's say, for example, you know, even Space Force has their own branch of cyber security. So, you know, in these things and in these interview processes and talking to these people, I said, well, how does this all work? You know, if I do get accepted to this job, you know, and you offered a job, how will the rest of, you know, my career plan play out? And it was interesting to hear that, well, you know, we're going to spend a lot of time to basically erase you from the internet, where you don't exist anywhere anymore on the internet. And then, you know, we're going to take you somewhere and we're going to train you on all of the advanced technology that is classified at this point. And I said, well, what do you mean? And I said, I'm graduating, you know, one of the best schools for, you know, information assurance. That was basically a center of excellence for the NSA. So you guys basically created the curriculum and helped us learn all these things and to get us prepared to, you know, for being a career in either private or public sector. And I said, yeah, that'll be a great historical lesson that you spent the last 4 years learning all these things that are old. And we're gonna teach you all the real things and everything that's we're really using in today's day, and we're gonna make sure you don't exist anywhere online. So if you see the crossover there, right, like you said, Bob Lazar or anybody else, you can just make your online presence disappear, make you disappear completely, and then train you on the most advanced technology that shouldn't exist, or that at least nobody knows exists, right?
It sounds so conspiracy theory and.
Oops. Sorry about that. Yeah.
I do that as well.
That was my cup of water hitting the microphone. But yeah, it does, right? It does makes it sound conspiracy or, but it's a, like I said, pattern recognition expert.
So what about this idea of collecting experiences DNA craft a drug?
That's what kind of really put the fire underneath me to get this book completed. DNA is the evidence that you can't really discredit, right? Now, you can dismiss an experiencer's testimony, but you can't dismiss it a genetic marker. So when you start asking questions about why certain experiencer populations show consistent anomalies in their biology, you're kind of left with the realm of a subjective experience, and you've entered the realm of hard science, right? You're not going from like, oh, I thought I saw these things in the sky, but you've entered a thing where it's measurable and it's, you know, you can look at it through a microscope. So the implication of that is enormous. I mean, if you had for whatever the phenomenon is, and for who is contacted and for why institutions have spent decades collecting the data without telling us, it's really, really troubling and telling. And it's part of the conversation that nobody wants to happen right now. Like we spoke about before, they want to spin the narrative to be lights in the sky, right? And they don't want anybody talking about DNA. They don't want anybody talking about experiencers, people that have had experiences and what that does to them, right? And that's, as I said, I kind of touched a nerve at one point and felt the burn, and I decided then, well, that's what they don't want me to pay attention to, and that's what they really want to hide. Let's dig into it, and I did, and I found out a lot. To give the audience a backstory, I mean, in the book, I do talk about a lot, an entire chapter about DNA, but what it all started for me was there was a great podcaster, and his name is James Iandoli. He's got a podcast called Engage the Phenomenon. He's the one who started me, kind of. He reached out and said, John, you should really do a podcast. And I said, I have no idea. He's like, I'll help you. I like what you have to say. You have a great voice for this. And, you know, I like your thoughts. And I said, okay. So he kind of helped me out, held my hand the whole way. And that's basically how I started UFOs on the Level, 6 years ago now. But he had a podcast. He was doing a podcast with a guy named Andrew Razowitz. And Andrew's also known as the Psychic Firefighter, who's had a lot of experiences on the psychic realm. And he also, it crosses over to UFOs, orbs, things in the sky, those experiences. And he was on the podcast with James, and he was talking about how Dr. Gary Nolan, Dr. Kit Green from the CIA and others are taking people's DNA, and they're also doing brain scans and MRIs, and they're not telling these experiencers what they're doing with it. They're basically saying that, hey, we'd like to have your DNA. We'd like to help, you know, come up with a rationale for this. Dr. Gary Nolan's on the record multiple times saying that he wanted to create a drug to turn on and off the phenomenon for people or psychic abilities. And I posted that clip. It was a 1 minute clip from that podcast that I posted. I just posted it on my Twitter page and said, wow, this is pretty interesting. What happened after that was Tom DeLonge from Blink-182, from, you know, TTSA, reposted it. And once he did that, there was millions of hits. And instantly, I had people in my DMs were saying, take it down. Especially, you know, Gary Nolan was in my DM saying, John, take it down. I didn't say that. And, you know, I said, I didn't say anything. This is two different people. This is not even my podcast. It's somebody else's podcast. And this is what this guy's saying. I don't, you know, I'm not saying it. You know, take it down. You know, you're this is bad. And then, you know, he blocked me. And then after that, it was when the claws came out, I would say. So I got basically shadow banned. Couldn't find my tweets. People that were talked to all the time couldn't see anything. My YouTube videos that would show up, and people that were subscribed and didn't show up anymore. Interesting that I got attacked from all sides, DM side and from everywhere else, all for something that I reposted. As I said, I wasn't the one out there making the claim. I was just reposting somebody else's experience, which was telling. And so I started digging. I said, what's going on? So I reached out to Andrew, and it took a little while. And finally, I got Andrew on the podcast, and I talked to him in private and public, you know, and public. We did a couple podcasts and spoke about it. And he came out and just said it. He said, Gary Nolan, Dr. Kit Green, Robert Bigelow's the money behind it at the time. They're taking people's DNA, experiencers' DNA, and they're not telling us what they're doing with it. And that was troubling. So if you just follow what they're saying publicly, that they wanted to create some type of drug to turn on and off the phenomenon, then that would make sense. And after doing more digging, followed the work of Dr. Dean Radin, who basically said that, yeah, we have a way intranasally that passes the blood-brain barrier, so maybe like a nose spray, that can turn on psychic abilities and anyone for a short period of time, or depending on the dose, forever. And you know, when you think about super soldiers and that experience, and Dr. Dean Radin said it on a podcast that he's saying it out loud now because he doesn't want something to happen to him or the research. And if something did happen to him or the research, at least everybody knows what's going on, which is very telling, right? Because, you know, from the background, I heard that once that started to happen, that it was classified and everybody had to be quiet and everybody had to keep that under wraps because, from, you know, Andrew and I speculated that And if you think about it from this perspective, then if you had a nasal spray that could turn you into psychic or maybe even telepathic, and you had an elite group of special forces, right? For example, in the US, that could maybe have this nasal spray before they're doing a mission, right? And what if they were able to do that and then not have to have radio communications? Maybe they can all speak to each other in their minds, and they knew what was behind the corner before it was behind the corner, and they knew where people were going to be before they were there, and how the whole thing was going to play out. It'd be the ultimate weapon. That'd be a $1 trillion industry that nobody would want to be, you know, revealed, right? So that would be something to keep massively quiet. And you know, theoretically, it would be massively protected and a fortune for whoever somebody did it. I'll read you the direct quote from Dean Radin, because I think it's very telling. It's in my book, obviously. This is him saying, "There's a slight danger that if I were successful, it would disappear, sucked up into some program somewhere, and super soldiers would be made. So if someday I disappear, and all this research disappears, at least somebody else will know what went on." So, right? So when it crosses over to the experiencers and UFOs, it's interesting. But I really got shut down. So I dug deep, and I put a lot of it in my book, and I think it's one of the biggest chapters as to why this is happening. And it's interesting. It's like we were talking about earlier. It's not part of the conversation that anybody's having on a public scale, right? They're talking about these craft that can do amazing things in the sky, but nobody's talking about experiencers or what happens after you have an experience, right?
Yeah, because there's these things where people see UFOs and the person standing next to them doesn't see the UFO.
Isn't it amazing? Yeah.
So that person, it could be that they're tapped into it somehow, and maybe it's part of their DNA. And so suddenly they could switch on everybody and everybody sees UFOs.
Right. Or the opposite, if you think about it that way. What happens if you would spray something over the sky or putting in some type of food or water, for example, where you're going to make an entire population not be able to see things that are right there? Or an entire country, right? So if we had a technology that would ran on consciousness and the craft, that conscious, and you could shield that would be the ultimate stealth, right? If you decided to, in this other country, for example, we don't want them to see we're coming. We're just going to do this for a couple of years. We're going to give them something that they're not going to see, and then we can just show up and be right there, and they'll have no idea. we're hanging out right above them, right?
So I wanted to ask, in a book about UFOs, why have you got a chapter on the Knights Templar?
Well, so part of that entire thing is when you look at the, you know, the lineage, it's like the esoteric lineage of the whole thing. It really ties deeply into it. So the line from the Knights Templar through the Nazi occultism into modern day military intelligence complex is documented. It's not a theory. It's there. The institutions they preserve specific knowledge and passed it forward throughout time. And so I'm a Freemason, and I kind of operate inside some of those initiatory structures. And I'm telling you that what the public sees is just really the surface. The traditions encode things deliberately, and the people inherited those institutions know it, and they've been using that throughout history. It really goes from since the beginning of time. It's power structures. People with the most money and the most knowledge tend to run society, and through that they keep these control systems through these institutions, and you know, preserving the traditions and the knowledge hidden. That's a lot of it's in plain sight. There's a massive crossover, I think, that also people are not aware of at all. Being a Freemason myself, I guess, as I said, that there's a lot of people that are Masons and public that you would never know about. And you know, everybody goes to the conspiracy part of that where, well, they're running the world. It's the Illuminati. They're trying to take us over. But the other side of it is that maybe they're protecting something that's keeping humanity together or keeping, you know, consciousness or the collective consciousness of the planet tighter and controlled to be able to help us, to save us from something that we may not even know is attacking us, right?
Do you feel the Knights Templar had some kind of special knowledge of something, perhaps something religious or spiritual, or is that just a myth?
No, I think they really did. And I still think you know, if you go through the history, and I do a like kind of a deep dive, but at a really high level, that they were digging at the ruins of King Solomon's temple for years. I think it was over 10, it was probably 10 years, I think. And there's multiple levels, and it's documented that they were there forever. They basically were in camp there. And the cover story was that they were the protectors of people that were making pilgrimages to the Holy Land. So the Pope allowed them to, you know, be the protectors of people that were traveling to and from, to keep people from being raided and, you know, murdered on the trail. And in that time, they did a lot of excavations underneath King Solomon's temple. And what they found, I can only imagine. I mean, there's rumors and stories and everything else, but whatever they did find, they held that very secret, and they kept it to themselves. And it at some point ran afoul with the Catholic Church and, you know, the other ruling nobility at the time, that whatever it was so sacred and secret that they wanted to keep it and preserve it and not let it fall into the wrong hands and be used for whatever other purpose it was. And was that a knowledge? Was it an artifact? Was it both? Everybody thinks that it could be all of those things, right? The Ark of the Covenant has always been tossed around. What is that, you know? I believe that they did, and I believe that they had that knowledge. But there was also a time in these vast voyages they did, they were part of the war branch of the Pope's army. They would show up to foreign lands and bring you religion, you know, bring God to you heathens. And they would, you know, fight. And there was a lot of recorded events where a lot of the other countries had institutions just like the Templars. They had degrees. They had a sacred esoteric tradition that they held, even though they were, you know, completely separate religion, separate ethnicity, everything. And they met together on the level as brothers. And they had a lot of cross-pollination where a lot of the other traditions, I think it's in religion, secretism, I think is the term. Basically, you're informing another brother of these traditions that we're doing on this side. And I think the Templars were a repository for a lot of the very ancient esoteric traditions that were basically wiped out by the Templars and by others as well. So the most sacred rites and rituals and things that these other, you know, countries, entities, esoteric traditions did were brought into the Templars, and the Templars had them, recorded them, kept them, and then even incorporated some of those in their own. So I think that is very interesting to see that maybe some of these things did exist and they still do to this day, and what those things are. What are these rituals? What do they do? Are they ways to connect to your consciousness or the collective consciousness? Is it a communication to non-human intelligences, perhaps? Are there things, for example, that they've been keeping secret? There's a whole list. I mean, there's hundreds of books, maybe thousands of books about the Knights Templar and those and speculations, but I really do believe that they did stumble upon something that they wanted to keep secret. And I truly believe they did it for the benefit of all mankind and not for just one power structure on Earth.
Been great talking to you. The book's called Contact and Control, UFOs, DNA, and the Hidden War on Human Potential. And people can get that on Amazon, can't they?
Yeah, they can. And if you want an autographed copy, just go to contactandcontrol.com and hit me up. I can do that, get that out to you, because I think that's cool. Help you out.
That's fantastic. And can you tell us about your podcast? Where can people find it?
Yeah, the podcast is called UFOs on the Level, and it's on all the podcast platforms and YouTube as well. And it's interesting because it doesn't follow the direct narrative of a UFO podcast. It, as we talked about, it runs the gamut from everything that we talked about here and everything we talked about in the book and more. So just a open forum pretty much to things that people have experienced and people are studying and authors and everything. There's a little bit of everything on there. So check that out. UFOs on the Level.
And thanks again for coming on the podcast.
Thank you very much, Simon. And you and I will do one as well. I want to interview you next and get to your side of this whole thing. And maybe you can do the hypnosis on me. See if we can dig into a little bit more on this white lady thing or in the other stuff. It'd be really interesting to see. We'll do it for a podcast. Yeah.
Yeah, it'd be interesting.
Yeah. Thanks again, Simon. You're awesome.
And that was an interview with John Majorowski about his book, Contact and Control, UFOs, DNA, and the Hidden War on Human Potential. My book, titled Aspects of Alien Abduction, will be published on May 25th, and you can pre-order the Kindle version on Amazon. And a great way to support the podcast is to sign up to Patreon, where you can get exclusive access to the extended version of this episode. Just go to patreon.com/alienufopodcast. And if you enjoy this episode, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.